How many bedrooms did your home have?
Well, let's see. It seems to me there was 3 bedrooms because a couple of us always had to share a bedroom.
Who did you share with?
It seems to me that I shared a room with Meyer a lot of the time. My oldest brother. The youngest and the oldest. That seems strange. So I think it varied at different parts, different times. I don't really remember that too much.
How was your home heated?
A big pot-bellied stove in the living room. That's the one that that we took turns about bringing in enough wood to last so we could bank the fire and keep the house a little bit warm during the night. I used to schlep in a lot of the firewood. I guess it was my turn already, you know, as I was growing up. The older kids did it first. But I'm trying to think who prepared the firewood. And it seems to me that we had some axes and we all sort of participated in keeping a pile of firewood there and bring it in. And we'd keep the fire going in the living room stove so that in the morning when Pop would get up, he would throw in a couple of logs and fire it up so that the house started to get warm a little bit. Of course, in the kitchen, we had a coal stove, wood stove to cook with in the early days.
So your bedrooms upstairs were not heated?
No, we would leave, no, they weren't heated. And yet, I don't remember too much about any problems with that. I think we just wore a lot of long underwear and warm clothes and had plenty of mom's homemade blankets and comforts and all that sort of stuff. But I don't remember that being a big problem.
What are some of your earliest memories of that house and that neighborhood?
Well, I think we covered that pretty well with the smoking episode and lighting the fire and we were just a couple blocks from a grocery and everybody knew everybody there and it was a very nice neighborhood. So far as all of our neighbors are concerned that we knew, we never really went to other people's homes for social occasions, but on the other hand, it was a very friendly neighborhood, and I don't ever remember any problems of being Jewish there. Every once in a while, there was somebody that made some kind of a disparaging remark in school, and I'd come home and report it. But around our neighborhood, it was a very friendly, warm relationship with all the people.
As a child, other than that school experience, did you have any experience with anti-Semitism growing up?
Not that I recall of any means, no. As a matter of fact, this might be a good time to sort of talk about some of the jobs that I did in the summertime. And 1 year we had a summer sale of dry goods, and I ran the store for Pop during the months I wasn't going to school. It kept me out of mischief and taught me some of my basic business principles that came in handy later. We would have some old tables there and some 2x4s or 2x2s and with nails sticking in them, and we would take socks and bandanas and all sorts of small things like that and run a little thread through them and hang them up there so that you walk along, there's a sign there that said how much the bandanas and the socks were, and you found the one you want, you just pulled on it, and it broke the little light string, or else you could lift it off the hook. But most of the time, we just... in order to get people in there, there was really no way to advertise very well. But I remember that on one occasion, when we had our opening of the Indiana Dry Goods Store, outlet store, we would buy something like sugar in those days, I think, sold for about 59 cents for 5 pounds. And we could buy it wholesale for about 39 cents. And in order to get a crowd of people in there for the store, we would advertise that the first 200 customers or the first 50 customers, I don't remember what the number was, could buy a 5 pound bag of pure granulated, the best name, sugar for 25 cents. Well, we figured out how much it cost us, you know, and it was the greatest average. People would line up there. Another time we did that with brooms. A broom would sell for about 79 cents, and we could buy them wholesale for about 50 cents, and so we sold the brooms for 35 cents. So if you gave away 100 brooms, you know, it's like running a $15 ad in the paper, but it got people would line up to get in there in the morning. We'd have different sales on different products like that. And we did that in Sweetser, and we did that in Fairmount, both of which are about 10, 12 miles from Marion, or closer to, Fairmount was closer to Gas City. But Pop would come over there and help us set up the store, and then I was the manager of the summer stores. And as a matter of fact, it was from the experience in the Fairmount store, where we had a second floor that wasn't being used for anything, that I got into a business. It was an outgrowth of that experience. It was in my senior year in high school, and I couldn't go to college. I wanted to go to Purdue University to be an aeronautical engineer. I don't know if I would have ever made it or not, but that was in 1933. I was graduating. I graduated high school in 1933, and I was in the depths of the Depression. And Milt was in college, and between Milt being in college and Ben working and Meyer working, and I was the only one at home. I couldn't go to college because we just couldn't afford it. And that's when I was running these sales and everything too. But in Fairmount, when we had a sale like that, and we had all kinds of piece goods and some work shoes and these racks of stuff that people could buy off and pull off with a thread. And there was a Lee Halperin in Marion who used to be in the junk business, and he became ill and went out west to forget where it was, a consumption restaurant or something. He had he must have been a tuberculosis, that's what it was. And he came home when he got a little better, and he came over to see me and wanted to teach me about the fur business. And he says, "You got a good place here, and I can show you how to do it. You put some racks up here." And make a long story short, when we were running the dry goods store downstairs, with his help and guidance, we were buying furs upstairs. And he showed us how to skin them. They would bring in muskrats and different furs, and each week the market varied, and we weren't either one in any position to do a lot of gambling. And the market, fortunately, that year went up a little bit each week, so we sold out right away. If we would have been gamblers and we would have held them longer, well, we'd have done better. But we did quite well, and everybody was talking about the fur business that I had gotten involved in. And there were a few mink around there. And there's a thing called a cotton mink, which if you blow into the fur, the roots of the fur is white, and that's a cheap mink. If you blew into the fur and the color went all the way down to the source where the hair started, that was a better mink, and you had to learn to price the different mink. And the first mink I bought, Mr. Lee Halperin really got a big chuckle out of it and laughed and gave me a lesson I'll never forget, because I had bought a house cat. that had been skinned and bought it from mink. I never forget that, but I never made that mistake again. But he couldn't take the cold upstairs, where, of course, there was no heat up there. He didn't want to heat up there where he was skinning the different furs. Fairmount was about 10, 11 miles from Marion, and every night we would take the remains of the muskrats after he skinned them, and he showed us how you could stretch them over shingles. You cut the corners of the shingles, stretch them, and hung them up on a wire rack. And every night when I would go home after the store closed, why, I had a couple, three boxes in the car, and I would dump them out on the side of the car someplace. That was the carcasses of the animals. We didn't know what else to do with them. We didn't need them. And I suppose other animals ate them or something, but it was a terrible thing to do by today's standards, dumping the carcasses of the meat out in the ditch someplace along the road. But it was an interesting experience, and about that time, friend of mine who lived in Marion, his older brother was a doctor, and his another brother was a newsman, and Irv Weinberg had gone to school to the medical school, and he'd flunked out, and he didn't want to go back to school, and he heard all about the fur buying business that I got into, and came over to see me, and wanted to know if he could go in business with it. Well, the fur buying season only lasted 3 months, and you had to buy a license, and we had a place where we could sell them every week, and it turned out to be pretty good. But he didn't have anything to do, and I didn't have anything to do, because by this time I had graduated high school, and so we decided to get in some kind of business together, and there was a economy pie plate, paper pie plate company that went broke in Marion, and they had a big quantity of picnic sets, packages that contained 8 or 10 or 12 paper plates, each two sizes, cups and napkins and everything. And we were able to buy about the equivalent to what you would call today a huge truckload of that stuff, and bought it for a fraction what it sold for. I don't remember the pricing, how it worked, but we were able to sell it for less than the wholesale cost that the groceries would buy for comparable items. And we would sell those house to house in the spring of the year. Of course, we bought them when nobody wanted them, when nobody was interested in picnics. And we did pretty well. And then when we ran out of that inventory, we're looking for something else to do, and we got with a laundry company that gave away laundry hampers if you did business with them. But if you stopped doing business with them, they had to give the laundry hamper back. And we distributed so many of those laundry hampers that they had to slow us down because they were investing too much money in the hampers. But that was two businesses we were in. And then another one was selling some other bankrupt merchandise, baskets and different things like that. And then all of a sudden, Irv Weinberg had heard of a friend of his that down south had gone out to the potteries and bought dishes by the ton and sold them by the piece. They were what they call lumpware. And we looked into this and got more and more curious about this business with the dishes that this guy down south had gone to the pottery and bought them and did pretty well at it. And this same trucker in Cass City that I told you about that gave us the big trucks to put the merchandise in when they had the fire at the store. We arranged to lease a truck from him to go to the potteries. And we had the names of a couple potteries, and we went there, and And we wound up buying some dishes, deep dishes and so forth. And we brought them back and we were able to peddle them and sell them and do pretty well. And we had rented a little store and decided to go bigger into this. And we went and took one of the Walter Low trucks to a couple potteries in Zanesville, Ohio, and upper, the whole area of potteries, Homer Laughlin in a little town in Virginia across the river from Ohio. And we scrounged up all the money we could get and borrowed some from friends of the family and borrowed some from Irv Weinberg's brother and some from Mom. And our first purchase was $300. We did all the loading. They'd supply us with straw. We would lay a bed of straw, and then we would take all the dishes and lay them out, and then a bed of straw and take all the dishes and lay them out. And it's a pretty dusty, dirty job. But when we got home, I remember we got into a big fuss with the owner of the truck because he says, I gave you a good deal on the truck for one day. But, it took us 2 days to load the dishes. It took us 3 days to unload the dishes, and we worked like beavers. I remember Mom came down to help, and a couple other friends of the family came down to help. And on Mother's Day of 1934, we had an opening of what we called National China or National Glassware Company, something like a National China and Glassware Company. We picked a big name. And our grand opening special was a 32-piece set of china for 94 cents. In the first place, it wasn't china, but we didn't know the difference. In the second place, we just said the 32-piece, how did we say it? I still got a copy of the ad at home. 32 pieces of chinaware. We didn't call them sets. But everybody knew the 32 piece was a typical service for eight. But we didn't say that they matched, and we didn't think that we had to say that. So we had some cups without handles. We had some dishes that didn't match. But for 94 cents, 32 pieces. What do you expect? And we sold quite a few of them. But we ran into some problems too because people just didn't quite understand how, you're supposed to have handles on cups and it's supposed to all match, and it wasn't chinaware. And but from this, we developed a china and glass business, and then we had our own truck. A couple times when I remember one truck and one time in particular, Mom would come in to watch the store when we went away, or Bell Weinberg came down to help a couple of times. He was Irv's sister-in-law. And they watched the store while we went to the pottery. And we had limited funds, and there were no credit cards in those days. And we had trouble with the truck. It was an old steak-body Ford or Chevrolet, something like that, and we had to put a new water pump in, and we only had about $5 or $6 left, and we had only gone about one third of the way to the pottery, and we were in trouble. And we went into a restaurant after we cleaned up from working on the truck, and we helped the guy in the garage do it and tried to do some other work for him so that it wouldn't cost very much. But we had spent about $25-$30 to fix the truck, and we couldn't bother the money that we had laid aside to pay the pottery, and otherwise we wouldn't have any purpose in going. And we had $5 or $6 left to buy gas and to eat, and it wasn't very much. But we walked in this restaurant, and it was a sort of a combination bar restaurant, and they had some slot machines there, and as young entrepreneurs, we decided, look, we're not going to have much to eat tonight because we've got to save this money to get to Zanesville and and potteries, and we decided we would invest half of what we had in the slot machines and take our chances. And we wound up making about $10 or $12 in the slot machines, and we sat down and we had a wonderful steak dinner. Those days, you know, it's a little different. And got to the pottery and loaded it up with all the straw and brought it back. And I suppose that could have been a very dangerous thing to be right down to your last few bucks and invest half of it in the slot machine. But we made it. We had a plan, and anything we made in the nickels and dimes we put in, we were not going to reinvest it. We'll use it to eat. And I guess we hit it pretty good. It wasn't a jackpot, but it was one of those where you get three of something and you win $8, and we won. We made a little money. We needed it. We got to the pottery and we got loaded and got back, and it took 3 days to unload the truck each time, and we got in trouble with the city because in the process of unloading, the wind was blowing and the straw was blowing, and we dirtied up the whole town. And we had everybody, shoe stores and friends, save boxes for us. And when people bought a set of dishes, well, we, you know, take out the boxes and load them up. We kept on doing that for several months, and then things got a little tough. It was still in the Depression year, and, you know, how many sets of dishes are people going to buy, especially the kind we sold. We began to get a few little better ones, too, but they were all seconds, and things were wrong with them. But we found out what people wanted. There were a lot of calls for deep dishes, you know, family-style eating and big platters and things like this. So when things got slow, one of us would stay in the store, and we'd take turns about taking a little truck we had at that time out to different farmhouses. And we would sell some dishes, some deep dishes, and we would go back to the bartering days. And sometimes we'd come back with a few dishes left and a few dozen eggs and a couple live chickens. And
just like your father.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, if people, they had what we could use and we had what they wanted to buy. And we sold these deep dishes, and then we got to another pottery where they used to make what the first semblance of Harker China Company. It was a an ovenware bowl with a mixing spoon, all made out of chinaware, but you could use it in the oven. Well, that was a pretty hot item in those days because you could use it as a mixing bowl. You could make potato salad. You could make whatever you want. You can make a pot of matzo balls and put them in, put a cover over it and put it in the oven and warm it. And we got 40 or 50 of those, and when we got them back, we sold them, I think, for $1 or $1.19, something like that. And these went out like hotcakes. So, and people were calling for them. And the next time we went to the Harker China Company, I think we must have bought 200 or 300 of those things, and we brought them back, and we ran a big sale, and did so well with it that we started looking for other closeout items, and we got some big deep dishes, and I can't remember some of the different stuff we got. Some of it we couldn't sell for love or money, so we would use those for special barter cases, but it was an era of great experience, and from this, we started getting some better, heavier china and selling a little of it to restaurants. Cheap restaurants didn't need the heavy vitrified china. They'd use the kind of stuff we made the 32-piece sets of china with. And we began to get glassware in, and we began to get some cheap silverware in, and as the business grew, and then we started developing the restaurant business. There was a guy in Fort Wayne, Indiana, that had the Hillman China Company, and he was a little annoyed by these young pipsqueaks that were down here selling dishes pretty cheap, and we were selling them up in Fort Wayne already by that time, because we found out that the Hill and China Company bought all their stuff from a salesman and had it shipped in, and we went to the potteries and laid it out in the truck on straw and hauled it in. We could sell it a lot cheaper than he did. Of course, we also sold seconds, he sold firsts. But one thing led to another in these discussions, and he wanted to know if we'd go to work for him, and he'd buy out our inventory. And we didn't want to do that. We didn't trust him. His reputation wasn't the best anyway. He was sort of a untrustworthy character with not the best reputation. And then we went ahead and developed our business in the restaurant end of it, and found out more and more that it was, you know, as long as you went out and saw the customers and knew what they needed and got it for them, that you could build a pretty good business this way. In the meantime, Hillman wanted to buy us out again, and offered us a real good deal, and he said he wants us to open a store with him in a college town, wouldn't tell us where it was, and he'd own 51% of it, and we'd own 49% of it, and he'd put in, loan us the money, and show us how to do it and everything, and the more we talked about it, the more we realized that he was going to have complete control of what we could draw out of the business and how we could do it and everything. And again, we didn't find anything very good about his reputation, but we found out from the little clue he gave us, it's a capital of a state, and there's no China store there, it's a college town, and we found out that it was Lansing, Michigan. And Lansing, Michigan is the capital, and they don't have a China store. And having found out where it was, we decided that maybe we ought to look into that. And we drove up to Lansing. We found we could, in any event, to make a long story short, I was the last of the boys to be at home. And things were pretty rough in the store, and folks were borrowing money to keep their heads above water, and it just wasn't the time that I could leave home to go to Lansing, Michigan, and from that we decided that we would split up the store, and Marion and Irv would go and business in Lansing, and I would stay in Marion. Well, we couldn't get together on how we could sell out, how we could divide it up. So we did just what I said. We get 12 of these, okay, you take six and I take six. Then we decided to divide up the fixtures. You can take the shelves on this side, I'll take the shelves on this side. And that's what we did, the whole thing, and we managed to divide a store without getting into a fight. And to this day, Irv Weinberg lives in Florida. I go down visiting on rare occasions, and from this we got into the restaurant equipment business, which has a lot to do with my future business arrangements with my brother and so forth. So we can talk about that at another time.